I've got some hope that this presentation is going to actually go to completion because we had some trouble installing it earlier today. So George kind of saved my Mac presentation into some Neolithic, Lenovo version, and I saw that about the first three of them were okay, so we'll see how far we can actually get in here. Seems like there's been a little bit of low temperature tolerance selection in this room already. I know it was a little cold earlier, so we're all kind of in the mood here for this, and so, feel free to get up and stretch a little bit if you'd like, but I'm going to talk about mapping low temperature tolerance in barley. And throughout the presentation, I'll have images of this research that have been submitted to me by different cooperators in this project. And if they're not credited, then those are images that I took. And if they're credited, then someone else sent them along. So like Bill Thomas at the James Hutton Institute here has a drone, and I wish I had one. And the barley low temperature tolerance experiment is just to your right there. And you can see kind of the scope and the size of this experiment. And as we'll see in a moment, there's about 1,000 accessions that are put out to look at low temperature tolerance. So it's quite a sizable piece of work. Dustin Herb, who's here in the audience, is the TCAP graduate student working on this project. Scott Fisk is a faculty research assistant that handles all of the logistics of shipping all of these samples around the world and keeping track of all of that very capably. Alfonso Cuesta Marcos was the brains behind this originally. He's now with Seminis in Woodland, and then Kevin Smith is a key collaborator and the bravest man that I know because he does work on low temperature tolerance in barley in a place where it actually gets cold. Like to certainly thank the USDA NIFA Tritici CAP grant for supporting this research. And then, as Kevin mentioned, I'm at Oregon State University. We're based in Corvallis. It's a place that doesn't get cold, but it does get cold on the east side of the mountain, so it's important for us there. And then we like to think that we're working both regionally, nationally, and internationally as well. And so low temperature physiology is something that we've been looking at for quite some time. This is Scott Fisk that I mentioned a little earlier in the foreground there. And if you've ever dealt with a large population, you got 1,000 individuals, that's a lot of bags, that's a lot of heads, that's a lot of seed, a lot of phytosanitary certificates. And so the logistics of just moving this stuff around can be kind of complicated, to say nothing of once you start to generate all the data that goes along with that. I'm going to kind of reverse things a little bit here and just point out some of the participants in this project, because if we didn't have these phenotypers out there, then this simply would not be possible. And so this lineup, as far as barley genetics goes and low temperature tolerance goes, it's sort of like putting Tom Petty and Bob Dylan and Mick Jagger all together in one lineup here, because you got sort of all these barley genetics rock stars, starting out with Steven Benziger at the University of Nebraska and ending up down with Bill Thomas at the James Hutton Institute in Scotland. Also important to point out that when we started putting this network together, it involves public sector collaborators and also involves a number of industry collaborators from Europe. And so we've been very fortunate throughout that it's been a very kind of open source sort of project without any limitations on the data or the germplasm exchange. So how do we fit into the overall TCAP sort of regime here? In terms of the applied goals of the TCAP, water use efficiency, nitrogen use efficiency are the two big efficiency traits. And then when we first started designing this project, I thought, gosh, it'd be neat to get low temperature tolerance into the barley side of things because it's something that we've been working on for quite a while. And we sort of fit within the WUE piece. And I'll explain that in a moment here as to how we see low temperature tolerance fitting in as a type of water use efficiency. The whole idea, of course, is to combine these phenotype data sets with the abundant genetics and genomics resources that we have, the SNPs that were afforded through the genotyping elements of the TCAP, put that together through a GWAS analysis, and then generate tools that we can use for marker-assisted selection for genomic selection. And you've heard about the applications of these tools in earlier presentations in this section, and then in the one that preceded it this morning in the Phillips symposium. So let's just dig into this question of low temperature tolerance and water use efficiency a little bit more and talk about fall-sown crops and how this can be an efficient, an approach to maximizing water use efficiency. In a situation where you have a winter precipitation pattern, and I'll acknowledge right up front we're talking about where you have a reasonable amount of winter precipitation, if you have a fall sown versus a spring sown variety of the same species, on average you'll have maybe a 20 to 25% yield advantage of the fall sown type. So on your right there, you'll see a winter barley. If instead of maize that had been spring barley at that particular location in the Skagit Valley of Washington, without irrigation, that winter barley would yield 25% more. Now, you get into a low temperature stress sort of environment, and of course, the risk is that you're not going to get that 25% yield, because if Mark Sorrells is doing this at Ithaca and you have a winter survival issue, then you may have 25% less on the fall sown crop than the spring crop. In environments where you can ensure survival, in environments where you've got that yield potential, then you can also save irrigation for higher value crops. And so as you see in this image, you got winter barley on the right, that corn is actually worth more to that grower, so it's worth that grower's time to put that save that irrigation water for that corn crop rather than to put it onto the barley crop. And in some environments, that may actually allow for double cropping. In the Pacific Northwest, we're really not able to do that. In Minnesota, you might be able to come back with a soybean after a fall sown barley, and that would be an additional advantage there. So if we tried to sort of just lay this out as a diagram in the left-hand quadrant there, you'll see in the current situation in the upper panel, you've got kind of a situation where in the winter, fall, winter, and early spring, you're just managing that ground. You may be engaging in some weed control, maybe some water conservation. And then come spring or summer, you're going to irrigate or have a lower yield. What we're looking at in the situation in the lower panel is that during the fall, winter, spring, you've actually got a fall crop out there. And so when you come then to spring or summer, then may be your management opportunity. So it could also allow the producer to flip the management schedules and thus get some weed control opportunities and other things out of it. So let's just get into the low temperature tolerance trait itself a little bit. There's a lot of semantics that go into this, and that you'll hear winter survival, winter hardiness, low temperature tolerance. Each one has a very specific definition, and we've just kind of grabbed LTT because it makes sort of a handy acronym here. What we're talking about is the ability of plants to survive the winter. The phenotype is deceptively simple to measure, that you can go out and determine how many plants came up in the fall and how many are out there after the winter's over. And so a number of things could be accounting for the fact that you don't have as many plants in the spring as you had in the fall. What we're trying to focus on is the effect that temperature has on that specifically. This is very much an acclimation response, and we're talking very much about low temperature tolerance at the vegetative stage. For the kinds of tolerance that we're talking about, once you've initiated that transition from the vegetative to the reproductive pathway that George talked about in the early symposium, then all bets are off. You're talking about an entirely different genetic system for low temperature tolerance at that point. I say it's a deceptively simple phenotype, and in the left-hand panel there you'll see the results of a trial we had out in eastern Oregon this last season, and you can just go through and actually rate fairly effectively based on phenotype if something is alive, dead, or somewhere in between. The panel to the right was from Kevin Smith's trial 2 years ago, I believe, where nothing lived, and the only thing that's alive is the winter wheat check, that little bit of green down in the lower left there. So you've got this sort of fine balance of generating some data that can be fairly robust and of fairly high heritability, but you've also got to deal with the vagaries of the environment, and G by E certainly plays a huge effect in something like low temperature tolerance. Couple of just other traits that are allied to this that we need to throw into the discussion so that we're all on the same page, and one of them is vernalization sensitivity. That's that period of low temperature that is required before the plant can transition from a vegetative to a reproductive growth stage, so that's a certain number of cold units that are input into the system. Then there's another piece of this that's very important, and it's photoperiod, but specifically it's a short day photoperiod situation where we're looking at day lengths of around less than 10 hours, more or less. You also have that delay from the vegetative to the reproductive transition, and so you'll see that short day photoperiod attribute showing up with increasing importance as we move forward, and specifically in terms of growth habits. And so we'll define three growth habits here. First is spring, and a spring barley in this definition would be one that is not vernalization sensitive, nor is it low temperature tolerant. Short day sensitivity doesn't matter because it's grown under long days. A winter barley is vernalization sensitive, it is low temperature tolerant, and it may or may not have short day sensitivity. The facultative definition, though, is a very important one. Where you do not have vernalization sensitivity, you do have short day sensitivity. It's absolutely essential, as we shall see, to have that attribute, and it is low temperature tolerant. So bearing in mind then those definitions of growth habit, we can then move into some of the genes that are involved, and then we'll move on into some of the results from the first year of research here. So the genetics of LTT, low temperature tolerance, are kind of a wonderful gallery of all the genetic mechanisms that we know of today. And so if you look at VERN1/FRH1, these genes are potentially synonymous. They may be pleiotropic effects of the same locus, but you've got a situation of alternative functional alleles there. And you also have a chromatin remodeling situation that's associated with that locus. You come to VERN2, and you have a gene deletion situation. You come to VERN3, FRH2, and you've got copy number variants operating. FRH3 is an unknown situation at this point. We don't know what's responsible there. And then the short day photoperiod situation is one where you have actually a loss of function allele. So kind of every genetic mechanism that's currently being explored today is operating within the context of low temperature tolerance and growth habit. You can start to see a little bit of growth habit difference, even at a fairly, this would be in the fall, in a trial in Hungary, this photo submitted by a colleague at the Márton Vásár Research Institute. So within the TCAP, we've had three LTT panels, and they're kind of nested within each other. And just to review what these are, when we first started with the project, we started in with the National Small Grains Germplasm Collection World Core. One of the key pieces of the TCAP project is to make full use of the genetic resources that have been conserved and characterized by the USDA. And so there is a subset of the total NSGC core that is the winter core. And so we looked at those 376 individuals in the field in Minnesota, and then in Western Oregon, where we did not have any differential survival, we looked at phenology, resistance traits, and so forth. Then we have another collection that's called the FACWIN6, and FAC standing for facultative, WIN for winter, six rows. This is where we started out my own program's contribution to the TCAP. These are all six-row genotypes. That's why it's called the six. There were 300 of these, and we looked at their low temperature tolerance under field conditions in Minnesota and in Utah. And then we looked at agronomics, we've looked at nitrogen use efficiency, we've looked at water use efficiency as well in Oregon and Utah. Then finally we come to the larger LTT panel, in which we have nested the TCAP FACWIN6 and selections from the winter core. That gives us this panel of 941 accessions. By the time you throw in the repeated checks that we use for our type 2 augmented design, you're up to about 1,000 plots, more or less, when you start to assess this. So we put this trial out at four locations in 2013, 2014, and then those are the data that we'll move into. You can kind of see just some of the differences between environments. Upper panel was at Corvallis, Oregon. This was a visiting scientist, Nora Hansdorf, who was with us at that point. Complete survival of all individuals. You can see some of the variation in height and color there. She's taking heading notes. The second panel is from T. Nakamura in Hokkaido, and you can see some early effects of mid-season frost on some genotypes there. And then the bottom panel is not the Sahara Desert, but rather that's Wooster, Ohio, after the winter, and that was from Eric Stockinger. And you can see the differential survival in those plots that enabled him to generate some very interesting data. So what's the germplasm that we're looking at? What are these 941 accessions? Just in alphabetical order here, starting out with Asia, ICARTA submitted a number of accessions from Uzbekistan, from Japan. The Research Institute for Bioresources provided us with accessions from a number of areas around Europe. and then around Asia, rather. And then in Europe, we had some private sector contributors here that are in italics, Lima Grain, Sacobra, Ackerman, Broin, Darzow, and BLL. Then a number of institutes in Hungary, Scotland, Spain, and then in North America, you'll see the states listed there, as well as the NSGC Winter Core. So we drew on a very large community out there to contribute these germplasm resources for the project. We start out with 14 locations with these accessions, 2013 and 14, with kind of a bandwidth across the northern hemisphere here. And out of those 14 locations, we had four locations that had differential survival in 2013-2014. And these included Alberta, Canada, where we were kind of surprised that we had any survival differential at all, Idaho, Ohio, and Minnesota. Of the other environments, we had one environment where there was complete death, and that was in Nebraska. And in the rest of them, we had complete survival with very small differentials. And so that goes to show that even in environments throughout Europe where we expected to have differential survival in Germany, in Hungary, in northern France, we actually didn't have any that year, thus underscoring the fact that you need to have tests in as many environments as you can possibly get. So focusing on those four environments then, we see sort of very different distributions and I guess you would call these highly abnormal distributions rather than normal, except perhaps Minnesota, which is sort of a flatline thing down there. But you'll see that in Alberta that you had a tremendous mortality and then just a tapering off of lines showing some level of survival, maxing out at 100 there. Full Pint is a spring barley variety. Alba and the local Czech. Alba is a winter variety. Maha is a facultative variety and the winter wheat Czech. Move over to Idaho, you see just the reverse. You saw that the spring Czech is lost along with a subset of accessions, that the facultative Maha is at about 70%. Alba, the winter barley, local Czechs, winter wheats are all in the 100% category. Alba behaves very differently in Ohio, where you see it down with the springs with complete mortality, the facultative up at 70% in the winter wheat, check up there in the highest category. Then in Minnesota, you see Alba and Maha together, along with the local Czech winter wheat up at the higher end of the distribution, full pint dead, and then a number of barleys in the 100% category. So we're quite excited to see some barley surviving in some places, and I'll give you a little more detail about who those survivors actually were or are in just a moment here. Let's look a little bit more at the environment and low temperature tolerance. This is looking at a biplot analysis of the data. And using a tolerance index here, where the accessions are grouped by their percent survival, with ones being those that showed anywhere from 75 to 100% survival, and then the other groups being corresponding 25% divisions of the total data set there, you'll see that you get this sort of very clean compartmentalization of the data with the blues up there with the winter wheats, a group of sort of intermediates, and then a cluster of the threes, and then finally on the other group of greens, which would be the very undesirable or very low temperature susceptible types. You also see differentiation of the environments here, with Ohio being sort of off by itself, Alberta, Minnesota, in this particular visualization being more similar, and Idaho being further, again, out in its own place. And harken back to those phenotypic frequency distributions that I showed you a little while ago, and that begins to make a little bit of sense there. But again, rotating the axes just a bit here, so then we see Idaho, Ohio, and Minnesota in this visualization being quite distinct from Alberta. But the thrust of this biplot is really to look at two-row, six-row differentiation. And for those of you who are not barley breeders, you've got two forms in barley. You're either a six-row, where you've got three rows of lateral fertile florets at each rachis internode, or you've got two. And this is not a vile gesture at this point. It's simply showing that you have two rows of fertile spikes. So no relationship there. That's very encouraging for us as barley breeders, because our industry is quite keen on two rows for malting, and so we wouldn't want to be in a disadvantageous situation in terms of selecting for maximum low temperature tolerance in two-row barley. We're fortunate to have the genotyping provided through the TCAP project, and then the workhorse for this research has been the 9K, which provides us an excellent reference genotyping data set. And then we move on to the Manhattan plots here for the four environments. They're in alphabetical order within the U.S. and then Canada at the bottom, not discriminating against nations at this point, but simply because Alberta did actually no effects exceeded the false discovery rate. So it's sort of down there by itself. But there's some kind of interesting trends that we might want to sort of track, and so we keep Alberta in this particular summary. So starting with chromosome 1H to the left and then moving over to 7H on the right, then we see some of the classic loci that I mentioned earlier appearing in this GWAS analysis. And so as many reports have done to date, the GWAS validates the effects of the biparental QTL studies and the limited GWAS studies conducted to date, as well as some novel effects. So just very quickly here, FRH3, this is the one that we see as a QTL showing up there, lined up across data sets, sometimes exceeding the false discovery rate threshold and other times not, but clearly with some associations of specific SNPs with the phenotype in that region that would lead you to think that there may be some consistency. Likewise, PPDH2, that's the short day sensitivity. There's something novel happening over on 2H, particularly in Idaho, that's worth a look. 4H, something novel, that's not VERN2, that's well into the sort of the Central America region of the 4H chromosome. FR2, consistently showing up across all environments, that's the CBF copy, the CBF cluster on chromosome 5H that's known to be attributable to copy number variants at that family of transcription factors, FRH1, which is this kind of meristem identity gene, also called FRH1, and then there's something novel happening on 6H and something on 7H as well. I guess somebody liked those Manhattan plots. So here's a little tabular summary of what we just saw, where the pluses. People much prefer tables to Manhattan plots. Susan McCooch said nobody wants to see Manhattan plots anymore, or something like that earlier on. But so here's just a little table to put that together. Just if you look, thank you. I'll stop. Yeah, okay. some consistent effects, and so you know certainly FRH2, FRH3 are there across all environments. The little squiggles indicating approximate. So we're just in, you know, we just finished up this GWAS at this point, and so now is the time to come to really then start to bore into what is actually underlying each one of those significant associations, and so that will be what Dustin and the research group start doing in the... What are they doing over there that there would be so much applause? Okay, so just to look a little bit at the germplasm itself, you know, these are the top 30 accessions that showed up across all environments. And so as plant breeders, not only do we want to know about genetic effects, but we'd like to know, hey, who's a winner? Who's a loser here? And so there's a couple of winners. The ones that are in red came from the Ohio program. So those are lines that Eric Stockinger had identified and selected and tested there at Worcester over the years. They're older materials. Those MO stand for Missouri. Those were materials developed by Pullman, I believe, quite a number of years ago now. The greens come from Oregon State University. I was gratified that we got some germplasm up there into the gold status on United Airlines. Minnesota's in there. He's got an MWG line. And then there's a smattering of lines from the NSGC core, so that's encouraging, tracing from around the world. We have also accessions coming, some of the founder genotypes from the James Hutton Institute. The EEEF Elan comes out of the Italian program. So there's a nice distribution of superior germplasm coming from locations throughout the world. So we've got geographic dispersion, and so now the next question is to ask, well, what favorable alleles have been fixed in what environments? What's the regulation of those favorable alleles? And can we start to pyramid these things into single genotypes? You see in the lower left panel there the kind of data we'd like to see. This is University of Minnesota, Kevin's program, and then this is Flavio Capitini at Alberta with a nice insulating snow cover over the trial during that time. So facultative growth habit, just to quickly move into this, of the top 30 that we showed you there, we have assessed the facultative growth habit only in material that came through the TCAP FACWIN6, and there are three facultatives in there out of the top 30. And so those are showing their percent survivals, one from the Minnesota program, two from the Oregon program. And then just this week, we've finished putting out all of the 941 accessions in the greenhouse to actually assay empirically then the vernalization sensitivity of all entries in there. So that'll be an adjunct to that data set. Why are we so interested in facultative growth habit? Because in my opinion, it's really an optimum for climate change. It allows the farmer to plant any time. Processors can source the same variety. As you're well aware, if you're in the plant breeding business, many of our processors want to have the same variety in order to maintain continuity of supply, and breeders can work faster if you're not having to deal with a vernalization requirement, either in single seed descent or double haploid production. So what are the next steps here in this project? This is Dustin, featured on the right there, my long-term collaborator on low-temperature tolerance work, Tony Chen, at Oregon State University. We're repeating the whole experiment this year. So we've distributed all of those accessions throughout the world. They'll be planted 14 locations again, generating a whole new round of LTP data. We're measuring vernalization sensitivity. As I said, we're going to move the elite material into controlled freeze tests, and we've got an abundance of other data. So those other 13 locations where there wasn't differential survival, those people took extensive notes on morphology, phenology, disease resistance, all sorts of other attributes. And so there's just a tremendous reservoir of data out there to put together that will allow us ultimately to look at basically all the traits of interest to breeders in the context of the genomic architecture of low temperature tolerance as well as for those other traits. The genetics genomics piece of this are quite exciting because we have candidate genes under some of those novel QTLs. What are those things? What haven't we discovered? And then underneath the ones that we know of, what on earth is going on? Why are we seeing FRH1 showing up when this material was selected to all be low temperature tolerant? We didn't expect to see sitting ducks or shooting fish in a barrel like putting in spring genotypes, except for our check there. And then obviously in the context of the TCAP, we're very much about breeding and introgression, that is accumulating all possible favorable alleles. Sort of moving off in the next application of this, we've got a an incipient, if you will, double haploid genomic selection program in winter 2-row barleys that has been sort of initiated independently from this, but these results will feed directly into that, and that's ongoing between us with Mark Sorrells at Cornell and then with Kevin Smith at Minnesota, and then I was just visiting with George this morning about how we could use facultative barleys also in California in that context. This particular image is from the trial in Bavaria this last season where they didn't have any low temperature differential, but you can see again the differences in morphology and phenology. With that, I'd just like to acknowledge all of the members of the Barley Research Group at Oregon State University who've contributed to this project, and note that we've got two TCAP graduate students, Araby Belcher, who is working on the nitrogen use efficiency and direct measures of water use efficiency as well as disease resistance, and then Dustin Herb, who's in the audience today, working on LTT. We have a TCAP undergrad, that's Deirdre Apple. She was pictured there doing the thinning of the material for vernalization sensitivity. We're fortunate this year to have a 10th member of the group, Bill Thomas from the James Hutton Institute, who's with us as a visiting scholar. And with that, I'd be glad to take any questions. Yeah, so the question is, well, actually, we need to complete the haplotype analysis of just this array to see if we have accumulated all favorable alleles in a single genotype. And so if that's the case at the QTLs that we know of, then there's probably some other things we haven't discovered yet or some regulatory things. But yeah, the goal would certainly be to combine, to pyramid, if you will, all favorable alleles into a single genotype and then ideally make that facultative growth happen. Anne-Marie, did you have before? Oh, okay.
It's not very scientific, but do you screen for the short day response in the greenhouse?
I wish I could. Answer is short day screening. No, because it takes actually a good bit of controlled environment screening to do short day work. That is, you can't have any light beyond the 10 hours. And so when we've done that kind of work, we've done it in cooperation with the group in Hungary that have a complete phytotron facility. And so that's kind of a tough one to get at. PPDH2 is pretty easy to genotype, so you can do a very good predictive job on who's going to be that.
We know that the gene for the allele is an FT allele, so probably most likely you can genotype two.
For the short day. You can. Yeah. So that's definitely a phenotypable sort of a thing, but it's also nice to validate empirically. The vernalization sensitivity, on the other hand, is really pretty easy to do because you can just put them out in a small cell pack and then just see if they flower in a reasonable time frame. Yeah.
All right. I think that's it for now. We'll have to keep on time.
Anne-Marie's
going to make an announcement in just a second, but let's thank Pat.